Wisconsin GOP lawmakers released sweeping legislation late Friday with plans to hold a public hearing on the bills today and floor votes tomorrow. We're talking about this lame duck session, the politics involved, what's at stake in the legislation. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Sean Johnson with an eye on all of it. He's WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
Well, so here we are, this lame duck session. Evers will be taking office in January, Tony Evers. Why are lawmakers meeting now?
They are meeting now because they want to pass things that a Governor Evers won't sign. And so these are bills that they think a Governor Walker will sign. They still have single party control in state government. And so, I mean, that's the motivation here. And a lot of these things will restrict the power of Governor-elect Tony Evers and Attorney General-elect Josh Call, both Democrats. And so obviously once they're in office, Evers is not going to sign stuff that restricts his own power, but there's a chance that Governor Scott Walker will. That's why you're seeing this rush.
Well, before we get into those specific bills that would limit power, have lawmakers held sessions like this in the past? What is the protocol here?
The last time that we had a session sort of like this was in 2010. In that case, you had Democrats had just lost elections and lost control of the Assembly, the Senate, and the governor's office. But their lame duck session was not nearly this long. Mm. It was confined to approving state employee contracts. And that was it. And then actually, that didn't even pass. This is a lot more. I mean, there are some pretty lengthy bills here that were introduced Friday afternoon about 4:30, and we're going to have a hearing on them, and the Finance Committee is going to vote on them today.
You're saying one of the bills is over 100 pages.
It was a bill, one of the bills on administrative rules and, you know, myriad other changes. Yeah, if you look at the bill itself, which is, it just encompasses a lot, and, you know, it's 140 pages worth of stuff.
So what do we know about what lawmakers plan to address in this extraordinary session? I mean, can you kind of break it down in groupings?
Sure, we can do that. It depends how they take all this stuff up. They could do it in one big bill or they could do it in a bunch. But there are a couple election law changes that are getting a lot of the attention. One of those would move the date of the state's presidential primary from April to March. And the significance of that is that it would decouple the presidential primary from Wisconsin's Supreme Court election. So what does that mean in 2020? Think about what might happen in 2020. There is, we have a Republican president. There's not likely to be a competitive Republican primary for president as we sit here right now.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of Democrats considering running for president, and there's a chance we would have a competitive Democratic primary for president in April of 2020. That's going to increase Democratic turnout in that election. And so what Republicans do by moving the election from April back to March is they insulate conservative Justice Daniel Kelly from being on the wrong end of that turnout. So put it in a lower turnout election when the presidential election, the presidential primary isn't going to affect turnout, and Justice Kelly has a better shot of winning. This is not just a theory that conspiracy theorists are throwing out there. I mean, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said last week when asked about the upside of these changes, he said, you know, this is part of the reason that we're doing this.
So Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke, a Republican from Kaukauna, has said that redistricting will not be on the table during this session, although some Democrats have speculated that it could be. What do we know about that?
That was the early speculation, especially from Congressman Mark Pocan, Democrat, mm-hmm. Who represents Madison. He said it was his concern that redistricting was kind of behind all of this. Mm. You don't see that in the bills that are out there, at least on the surface. So there are provisions in there that would affect Attorney General Josh Call and his power. Perhaps that would play a role in a redistricting court fight. There are provisions in there that give the legislature more power to retain counsel on its own, that the legislature is sort of insulated from the Attorney General's office and would have its own power, you know, its power to hire attorneys much more easily. Perhaps that would be a factor, but there's not a direct, you know, redrawing of the maps or something like that in this.
Talking with Sean Johnson, State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio, looking at this lame duck session and what it could mean. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What particular bills are you watching for? Have you read some of the legislation over the weekend, and what sticks out at you? What do you think about GOP lawmakers taking up sweeping legislation? 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR. Mornings. So there had been lots of talk about the Kimberly-Clark incentives and the plant in the Fox Valley. Is that coming up anywhere in this extraordinary session?
As it stands right now, probably not. So remember when we
because
first started...
Because that was like the impetus, right? That's where...
That's right. When we first started talking about the possibility of an extraordinary session and then an extraordinary session after Election Day, Kimberly-Clark was the subject. Then what leaders were saying was, well, maybe after the election, people will look at this issue differently and we'll try for a vote then. Senator Fitzgerald said he has 10 or 11 Republicans who are prepared to vote for that in his caucus right now. And that means there's, you know, 7 or 8 Republicans who don't want to vote for it. And Democrats have said that Republicans have not reached out to them. So as of right now, that appears to be an issue that, you know, we won't even hear about on the floor. And so you have this other stuff, though, taking its place. Mentioned the election date. I didn't mention in that same breath, though, we're talking about restricting early voting as part of that same election package. And the list goes on. We'll get into it.
Well, let's look a little bit, Sean, on Sunday, Evers had some things to say about how voters would feel about the lame duck session. And let's hear a bit of that.
I believe that and I've heard from many of them that their concerns are as valid as mine, that this special session bill, it will take us to a place that the people of Wisconsin will feel that their vote has not been counted or valued.
Has not been counted or valued. Those are pretty strong words.
For Evers, yeah. I mean, and I guess he also says, I want to try to work with people in kind of the next breath. He's not kind of an attack dog type of governor by any stretch of the imagination. But what he's saying there is that we just voted for a Democratic governor, Democratic attorney general statewide. And before those people, you know, he's talking about himself there, take office, we're going to make these offices less powerful.
And limiting not to Evers, but to Josh Call, as we getting close on time here, but how would Evers, his powers be limited first?
Evers' powers, mm-hmm. just, I guess, in a variety of ways. He would, I mean, just like a one example to throw out there, and this is not necessarily the biggest, but right now you can carry concealed weapons in the state capitol building.
Mm-hmm.
That's up to the Department of Administration to set that policy. The legislature here is saying, actually, we want that run through us. So Tony Evers couldn't make the Capitol a gun-free zone, for example. Another example, Tony Evers and Josh Call both ran on getting Wisconsin out of this lawsuit to overturn the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
That was their big issue,
yep.
If you remember. And what this bill would do is say those kinds of decisions actually have to be approved by the legislature's budget committee, where Republicans have a 12-4 majority. So it would take away the power of Evers and Call to fulfill that campaign promise.
Governor-elect Tony Evers and Attorney General-elect Josh Call reacted to the lame duck session last week, saying GOP lawmakers are, quote, overriding the will of the people. What do you make of this extraordinary session? 800-642-1234. WPR State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson stays with us here on The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Republican lawmakers released their lame duck session bills late Friday. The proposals make sweeping changes. Among them is to move the 2020 presidential primary from April to March, as we talked about, and limit in-person early voting to a 2-week window before an election. We're talking about these measures and what they're intended to do here on the State Capitol Report with our Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. He's with us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And let's get your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Do you think these bills would limit the powers of the incoming governor and attorney general? What specific measures are you focused on and why? And is this lame duck session necessary to preserve the work of Governor Walker's administration? Join in. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's bring in Leslie now, joining us from Elm Grove. Good morning, Leslie.
Thank you for spending time on this. My question is, do you think there has been enough time and focus over the weekend since they just dropped these bills on Friday and are voting on Monday to put pressure on these arrogant elected officials to withdraw and nullify our vote? We just had a surprising victory on November 6th. The voters have spoken, and this is a blatant power grab. Everybody knows the Supreme Court has become a partisan election with special interest groups on both sides spending millions to win these seats. So,
Leslie, thank you so much, Sean. I want to get you a chance to jump in there on what Leslie is saying about the timeline here.
In terms of how fast it's moving?
Yes, how fast it's moving.
It's pretty fast. I mean, no way around that. The bill's introduced at 4:30 on a Friday. Public hearing today at 12:30 by the legislature's budget committee, possibly a vote today by the legislature's budget committee, possibly assembly and Senate action on these things tomorrow. That's not firm yet, but that is a fast timeline.
And with a public hearing, you can come and, be a part of that public hearing. But this is very quickly to have to perhaps change your plans.
Oh, yeah. Very, very quick. And I mean, you move quickly like this if you're a legislative leader, because, these are the kind of things where potentially the longer they're out there, people could get uneasy about them, especially the changing of the election dates and the restricting on early voting. Senator Luther Olson, a Republican, didn't give a firm, opinion on this, but he said he wasn't sure that was going to pass when he was quoted in the Journal Sentinel over the weekend.
Let's bring in Emily now in River Falls. Hi, Emily.
Yes, hi. My name's Emily Seegers, and I actually ran this past cycle for state assembly against my state representative, and I brought in 46% of the vote in my district. And as a first-time candidate, my map is pretty crazy. I have four counties that I would have represented, and I ran on being transparent and being civil and promising that we would be working across the aisles with one another. And I've tried to get a hold of my then opponent and my state representative Dan Knodel and my state senator Alberta Darling, and with no luck, I haven't heard back from either of them, because I know this is isn't what District 24 residents would have wanted. Actually, Tammy Baldwin had won my district. And so gerrymandering does play some role, but it is a winnable area. And I think that says a lot about how people view our government right now. And so this is really disgraceful to see our representatives first not listening to their constituents, but also just streamlining this into a 48-hour process and not really listening to any of us.
Emily, thanks for the call. Streamlining into a 48-hour process, it does put some roadblocks in trying to reach out to your lawmaker.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And for the most part, a lot of those legislators have already told their leaders that they're comfortable with these ideas, or we wouldn't be seeing them in bill form. That's not to say that they're all going to pass, but the reason that you're seeing this now is because they've been meeting on this stuff privately and kind of getting a consensus of where the caucuses are on these issues. And the fact that they're in bill form tells you that a lot of these legislators have already decided this is something that they could support.
Let's focus in a moment a little bit more here, circle back to health care. The legislation plans to address the lawsuit that the state filed to overturn the Affordable Care Act. What is going on here and the impact on Josh Call and Tony Evers?
This one was a surprise. Not that there weren't quite a few of those in these bills, but I think, my presumption after the election was whatever else happens with divided government, there's only so much a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature are going to agree on. But We do know that Governor Walker authorized Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel to get into this lawsuit to overturn the Affordable Care Act. We know that Tony Evers and Josh Call said they want to get out of it. So it seemed like that was one where, okay, Wisconsin will get out of that lawsuit. The lawsuit will continue because there's 19 other states that'll remain in it. But Wisconsin's going to get out of that one. That appears to not be the case if this goes through, that it would need to go through the legislature's budget committee first. I don't know if that raises a separation of powers issue.
Could it land in court?
A lot of this stuff could land in court potentially, okay. Especially the restrictions on early voting. Because the reason we have more expanded early voting right now is because of a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit. There were restrictions on early voting that were passed by Republicans several years ago. This lawsuit overturned those, lawsuit by One Wisconsin Now. Mm-hmm. And so Republicans are now putting some of those back, not the same ones back, but some of those back. So that, if you're looking for something that could be subject to a court challenge, that seems like the most likely issue that could end up there.
So if Republicans do pass a measure guaranteeing coverage for people with pre-existing conditions, it will only be effective if those provisions of the Affordable Care Act are repealed. And that's looking less likely now that Democrats have control. But another healthcare issue lawmakers might address this week are Medicaid waivers. What changes are we looking at there?
What they're looking at there is everything that Governor Walker did when it came to putting, you know, work requirements in place for Medicaid, things like that. The legislature wants to restrict Governor-elect Evers' power to get out of those. Mm. Because as it stands right now, that is a power of the executive in Wisconsin, a power of the governor, that when it comes to these waiver requests, you know, essentially asking the federal government for permission to do things slightly differently in the Medicaid program, a governor could say, I would actually like to rescind that request and we'll go back to normal. What this is doing is preventing a governor, preventing a Governor Evers from taking that step.
Well, there are some changes to elections protocol that lawmakers might make. Here is Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald talking about why lawmakers are considering changing the date of Wisconsin's 2020 presidential primary.
Certainly, I think there's many people that think that Justice Kelly would have a better chance if there's not really this competitive Democrat primary for president. That's the concern, I think. But I got to be honest with you. I mean, I think the campaign would be just as concerned that would be a criticism used against Kelly in the end. So there's a lot, you know, obviously a lot of it has to do with the political pieces to this whole equation. So.
Now, you started out the conversation with alluding to this a mm-hmm. little bit. Can you tell us what is being said there about Justice Daniel Kelly, Governor Walker's pick for the state Supreme Court?
Well, Senator Fitzgerald was asked about the upside of making this change. And I guess Senator Fitzgerald was pretty transparent in describing the pros and cons of this move. And the pro, as far as Republicans are concerned, is that Justice Kelly will have a better shot of things. Justice Kelly is Governor Walker's appointee to the state Supreme Court. Republicans currently hold a 4-3 conservative majority on the court. So there is an election next year that where Democrats would need to hold that seat. Justice Shirley Abrahamson is retiring, so it's open. That's not a given. But if they hold that seat, then that would put a lot of importance on the spring 2020 election. Justice Kelly becomes the swing vote on the court, and that election could tip the balance either way from a 4-3 conservative majority to a 4-3 liberal majority.
Another thing, Republicans might be giving the legislature more power in choosing members of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Why would that change be significant? What's going on there?
That actually, if you look at the bills that just came out, is more significant than we previously realized, because what it would do is there are a couple versions of it, but in essence, it would give legislators a majority of the appointees on the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation board. How they do that exactly would vary depending on these bills, but the end result is instead of having a majority of gubernatorial appointees, legislative appointees, and specifically people appointed by the majority party in the legislature, Republicans, would be running the Wedick board. not only would they be running the WEDIC board, they would, that board would now hire the CEO. Right now, that person is picked by the governor. So this would become a legislative agency, which is really unusual. It's already an unusual agency because it's a public-private agency. Now it would be a public-private agency under control, effective control of the legislature, not the executive. Very unusual, and a way of legislators to protect that agency. That's something that Tony Evers said he wanted to get rid of on the campaign.
Lots to watch here. Sean, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Sean Johnson is the State Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next, we talk to a reporter about what's at stake for the alcohol industry in Wisconsin as lawmakers consider changes. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Healthcare was a top issue in the November election. Voters let politicians know they want to keep protections for pre-existing conditions. Others wanted to expand coverage for more low-income residents. Shemaine Mills looks at whether the state's newly elected Democratic governor can deliver on these promises.
Carmen Ivanko had a potentially life-threatening health problem 2 years ago. At the time, the 56-year-old Madison resident didn't realize what was happening. She was having a heart attack.
I just had this weird stomach ache all day that was just annoying. And I ended up going in and, you know, like maybe it was an ulcer or something like that. I almost didn't go because I wasn't sure about the status of my health care at the time.
In the end, it all worked out. Medicaid, known as Badger Care in Wisconsin, paid for angioplasty to open up a blocked heart artery, along with physical rehab. But the single mom might lose benefits again when her last child leaves home, unless the state expands Medicaid. Right now, the program covers single adults up to the federal poverty level, a little over $12,000 a year. As a professional gardener for private clients, Ivanko's income fluctuates, and there's a chance she could make too much to receive Medicaid.
I'm terrified. Absolutely terrified. I can't go without health care, and I think most people shouldn't have to.
During the gubernatorial campaign and after his election, Tony Evers promised to do things differently. Republican Governor Scott Walker had rejected federal money to expand Medicaid. Evers would take it.
We can change how health care is delivered in the state of Wisconsin by taking that Medicaid money. That's absolutely important, and we'll do that.
That lawsuit to end the Affordable Care Act, Walker got the state in, Evers would get Wisconsin out and protect pre-existing conditions. And Evers recently indicated he could stop a Walker initiative to make the poor work for health care. Whether Evers can deliver remains to be seen. Donna Friedsam is Health Policy Programs Director at UW Population Health Institute.
No, I don't think things are clear-cut. I think, though, that it was a consequential change with a new governor taking office, and I think we will absolutely see certain changes be made, or at least significant efforts toward changes being made.
The question is whether that effort will matter. Republicans still hold large majorities in both houses of the legislature. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has dug in against Medicaid expansion. Appearing on WISN-TV, Voss said Medicaid pays doctors so poorly they have to jack up prices for other patients.
Why would I want to put more folks onto Badger Care, knowing that that would raise the private insurance rates?
Evers might have more leeway when it comes to changing Walker's Medicaid work requirements, says Robin Rudowitz. She's Associate Director for Medicaid and the Uninsured at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
The new governor-elect, even with that approval from CMS, could decide to not implement that provision.
But Evers could lose the power to make that change and others, depending on what the legislature passes in a lame duck session before Walker leaves office. The legislature could also block Evers and Democratic Attorney General-elect Josh Call from dropping the state's lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act. Some remain hopeful that health changes will happen because many voters indicated that's what they want. Whatever lawmakers decide could affect people like Carmen Ivanko. The heart attack victim is now fully recovered and working, but she says she can't afford health care after paying for rent, food, and transportation.
I'm hopeful that we'll have some better things going on for Wisconsin and more than just healthcare situations with a different governor.
But how much change there will be could depend on politicians who didn't agree on much before the election and still don't. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Let's turn now to the Legislative Council Study Committee on Alcohol Beverages Enforcement that has been meeting for 5 months. Their work to update the state's alcohol laws, iron out how to enforce them, and draft legislation has all been an uphill task. We're talking about the state's three-tier system and what the future holds. Do you own a business where alcohol is served? What's your experience with the way Wisconsin regulates alcohol, and what needs to change? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Caitlin Farrell. She is a public affairs and investigative reporter at the Cap Times, and her recent piece is titled Questions, Disputes Remain in Wisconsin Alcohol Industry as Committee Winds Down. Caitlin, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So last Wednesday, this Legislative Study Committee approved several pieces of draft legislation related to alcohol shipments. What happened there?
Sure. So this was the culmination of several months of this committee meeting. They talked about a lot of different issues, but in the end, the main thing that they ended up passing was something that I think several different players in the industry were in favor for, but really clamped down on out-of-state shipments of beer, wine, and spirits, and really providing a mechanism for the state to track that better and then make sure that taxes are paid on it and that actually alcohol that is alcohol, that it's not like moonshine or some other type of substance, it happens. And so right now it's pretty easy to ship anything into the state, and the state doesn't really enforce. You're supposed to have a permit, but the state hasn't really been enforcing that. And so there's really no way of knowing how much is coming into the state as far as that type of liquor. So
Yeah, and I mean, these are shipments coming in from FedEx and UPS, and no one's there to really look into what is coming across the state lines when it comes to alcohol.
Right. Yep. And several, so alcohol retailers and wholesalers particularly think that this is a real problem. And so these common carriers, UPS, FedEx, part of the draft legislation, this is quite a few steps away from possibly becoming law at this point, would require those shippers to create reports. And so then they would give those reports saying, you know, we shipped X number of beer cases, spirits cases to this address. Here you go, state. Now you have an idea of how much is actually coming in, and you can make sure that this liquor is what it says it is and tax it and regulate it as you see fit. So
we hear the words three-tier system. Can you help us break that down, and what is this three-tier system?
Sure. So the three-tier system is basically a regulatory framework. Wisconsin is one of several states that have this. It came from the era of prohibition to really try to prevent monopolies and make sure that the state could really regulate and control the types of alcoholic beverages that were being produced, distributed, and consumed. So the first tier we really have is alcohol producers and manufacturers. So that's like people who make beer, breweries, wineries, distilleries. And then we have a middle tier that are wholesalers or distributors. So when you want to sell that product, you sell it first to a wholesale company. And then that person goes and in turn sells it to a tavern, a grocery store, and those are retailers. So we have producers, wholesalers, and retailers. And they are divided in the law. I guess each tier has restrictions and limitations on what they can and cannot do. But over the years, that has become a bit muddled and confusing as we've seen new types of businesses prop up or sprout up, like, a lot of craft beverage.
And they don't fall into a specific tier, or they perhaps cross over.
Right. Yeah. And it gets from here, it gets very complicated.
Murky.
So they, brewers, a craft brewer or a craft distiller still would fall into the tier of a producer, but many of them want to do different things. They want to have a different type of business model. They might want to have a tap room and then they have a tap room and they want to also sell wine or sell another kind of spirit. And that's where it gets murky, where we have seen in the past people who are producers also being retailers of another substance. And then other types of retailers get upset about that. And there has been a kind of a cross tier going on that makes some players upset.
Let's go to Marie joining us from Barneveld. Hi, Marie. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Doing well. Go ahead.
So I own a company called Brick Cider. We're a hard cider company, which is basically under the legal structure of a winery, both federally and in the state of Wisconsin. So basically, I own a winery. And, you know, the three-tier system has definitely been a challenge in that as a small company, I mean, we're making 6,000 gallons a year, which is really, really small. We have to do all our distribution through a co-op, which is fine. There's a nice little tweak in the law for us that allows us to both produce and distribute, and then it does allow us to have a tap room, which is great, except the Tavern League has lobbied over the years, and I have to close my doors at 9 p.m., which is pretty insane if you think about it, when every bar in the state, every brew pub in the state can basically stay open, you know, as late as they want. The Tavern League has done a lot of successful lobbying in the state and has made it so that wineries have to close at 9.
Well, Marie, thank you so much for the call. What do we know about the lobbying effort and the PACs?
Oh, right. Yeah. Yep. What Marie said is completely true. There has been a push. I think there's been three different bills over a variety of legislative sessions to try to expand that to at least midnight. But that's true. Wineries have to close at 9. And the Wisconsin Winery Association has been pretty vocal in the past just about how unfair they think that is, that it unfairly limits their ability to host weddings and other events that might, you know, fall into the night. And so there's been a push for that. And it's been blocked each time, and ostensibly, you know, the Tavern League is a big lobby player, along with the beer wholesalers, the Wine and Spirits Institute. There are players there, but I think the entity behind that, who's been most against that push, has been the Tavern League specifically. So, one of the things I reported in that story too is that we've seen we've seen the establishment of a political action committee on the side of the Craft Beverage Coalition, which is a relatively new group in this sphere. We've seen wholesale groups exist for a while. The Tavern League has been around for quite a long time, and now that we've seen some pushback, some folks want changes to the way the three-tier system currently operates. We've seen craft wineries, breweries, and distilleries form their own group. This group, the Craft Beverage Coalition, created a PAC in July. They've said that they created it because they want to be more of a political force and really do their own lobbying. So they've been closely allied in the past through Americans for Prosperity, and that's where they've really gotten a lot of their legs as far as a lot of light coming to how these changes are done. A lot of the tweaks we've seen in the law have come through the budget, and so there has not always been, a long hearing process with a standalone bill, so which has kind of at times made it difficult to track the changes we see to this.
Talking about the state's alcohol laws and enforcement and the work of a legislative study committee with Cap Times investigative reporter Caitlin Farrell, you can weigh in on how Wisconsin goes about licensing and regulating. Do you rent out your barn for private events like weddings? Do you have a liquor license or use licensed bartenders? What do you think about this? 800-642-1234. Stay with us on the morning show here on the Ideas Network. Alcohol wholesalers have called for stepped-up monitoring and enforcement of our alcohol laws here in Wisconsin. The State Revenue Department has 10 agents to track and enforce licenses. They're trying to cover enforcement for tens of thousands of businesses across the state. We're talking about the state's alcohol laws and enforcement and the work of a legislative study committee with Cap Times investigative reporter Caitlin Farrell. You can join in on how Wisconsin goes about licensing and regulating. Do you rent out your barn, perhaps, for private events? Do you have a liquor license or use licensed bartenders? What do you think about having a class of regulations for wedding barns? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So, Caitlin, what is this issue around wedding barns? Because outgoing Attorney General Brad Schimmel recently suggested that wedding barns should be subject to the state's liquor laws.
Sure. So this is an area where, it's murky because the law doesn't directly address this type of business, which we've seen grow in popularity over the last few years. So basically, wedding barns maintain that they do not right now. Some do, but many do not hold a state liquor license. And so the ones who do not hold a state liquor license say that they don't think that they should have to, because they're not selling alcohol. They're not producing alcohol, they're not distributing it. Many of them say they have licensed bartenders who come onto their premises and serve that, but they maintain that they're not in the business of alcohol. And so although they create a space where someone can rent it out and a caterer is involved, that they shouldn't have to hold a liquor license. So folks, some folks, Tavern League included, says that, well, you're basically creating a space where people come and consume alcohol. This isn't, there's alcohol, you know, going on there, consumed, it's being given out. And so this should be regulated because this is a controlled substance that the state should be looking at. And so there's been a lot of lack of clarity in the law about whether the state has the right to enforce that. And recently, outgoing AG Brad Schimmel wrote an informal opinion. So this is not binding law. Mm-hmm. It's just something that attorneys would look to when trying to understand what the law would say, saying that, in effect, wedding barns would constitute a public space, which would make it necessary for them to hold liquor licenses. So in broad strokes, the opinion that he wrote basically would align with what the Tavern League is requesting, which is that they hold liquor license. And so the Wedding Barn Group, they're organized through an organization called the Wisconsin Agriculture Tourism Association. They maintain that they're going to fight that. They don't want to have a license. And again, I think some barns do have a license, but others don't. And I think that this is going to continue to be a sticking point.
Well, this is private property, and there may also be municipality building codes involved.
Yep, that's right. And they are regulated in other ways through other entities. So on the municipal level, you know, they have a building inspection, they adhere to fire codes. There are local officials that are, you know, monitoring what they're doing and making sure things are safe ostensibly. And so that's often the argument that we hear from the other side, is it's not like they're not regulated in any way. But as far as the alcohol is concerned, some are not really regulated. I mean, other than, you know, they might have a licensed bartender come in, but a caterer or the person who's holding the event can, you know, some barns let them bring in whatever they want to serve to their guests.
So are businesses in the industry aligned on how they want Wisconsin's system to change, or does it differ from tier to tier? Like, who's in whose camp, right?
Right. It really differs from tier to tier in some ways. In broad strokes, I would say many craft producers have advocated for an overhaul of the entire system. So they call this a modernization of three-tier. I mean, they really want the structure that we've seen for decades to be fundamentally changed. So we see that. The wholesalers and retail tier fundamentally do not want that to happen, so they disagree with that. When we get into some of the finer points of this discussion, then we see different tiers allied with each other. So often we'll see, you know, retailers often have their own set of interests, so wedding barns is more of a concern for them maybe than we might see with wholesalers, although wholesalers largely agree in premise with what retailers also say is a problem. I would say wholesale, retail, and craft to some degree all think that, though, one way they come together is that there is a lack of clarity in the law. They're not quite sure, you know, how are we going to interpret it today? Is it going to be enforced? And that, you know, doesn't do any of the tiers justice. And so I would say, though, we hear a lot more about enforcement, and some changes at DOR from the wholesale tier and the retail tier than the craft tier.
So as you say all of this, in my mind worrying a little bit, did the study committee make any progress over the 5 months? I mean, did they set out to do something and figure out something?
You know, largely no, I don't think. I think that, I guess, in the large scheme of this large problem, not a ton of progress. I mean, I think many folks think that dealing with out-of-state shipping is a good step forward. That's really one thread, I think, in a host of issues that are still going to come up, and we're going to see, you know, be fought on this. And so the larger premise about the lack of clarity in the law and DOR enforcement, you know, wasn't dealt with. And then, you know, with the outcome of the election in November, that really threw everything up in the air, because, you know, they could have passed some, you know, sweeping legislation that would have gone on one side or the other. But at the end of the day, we don't really know what the Evers administration is going to do. And so, you know, DOR could ramp up enforcement, they could hire a bunch more people, or he could keep it as status quo, he could fundamentally change the approach to enforcement. So I think that was a factor in the committee as well, although, you know, it really wasn't set up at the outset to deal with, I think, what a fundamental question and dispute was.
So, and this committee is not really going to dissolve, is that right? They're going to kind of stick around, or?
So it will adjourn eventually, and it would. It's a session-based committee, so it won't translate into the new year. They'd have to reestablish it. It just stops short of adjourning for now. I think there was a thought that, yeah, it would be its last meeting earlier this month or last month, but it'll be done by the end of the calendar year, in effect. I think that they just, the chair, Rob Swearingen, had said that he wants to kind of keep the door open to maybe talk with the transition team, but we won't see this in the next legislative session. They'd have to reestablish it.
Wisconsin is among a number of states, though, with a three-tier system. Could we look elsewhere for some guidance, for some inspiration on how to better regulate and enforce?
Yes, we could. I think the degree to which we should do that and the lessons that we should learn from what other states have done is definitely a point of discussion here. Folks that are calling for a modernization or a total overhaul of the system have said that we should adopt some of the practices of other states, but when we've seen that happen, there have also been some unintended consequences and issues with that as well.
Like what?
We've seen some, I'm not totally clear on what's gone on, but I know there's been issues in like Massachusetts and California, and I think some of it involves, you know, liquor that isn't really liquor. So if you're buying like Smirnoff vodka, it could be like bootleg, not really from that. We see just a lack of control and then more players flooding the market, and you're not really sure what you're getting necessarily. So I think that's happened in some places. And so I think wholesalers and retailers often are more wary of that. Like they say, you know, three tiers really working, and see these other states have totally dismantled it, and look at what they're, you know, they've run into some problems. And so, but yeah.
What does the fate of Wisconsin's system look like then, you know, under Governor-elect Tony Evers? Do we have any indication?
Not that I have been able to discern. The folks that I've spoken to who track this don't know. I've asked. I think the thought is that he will replace the folks at the Department of Revenue, but no one really knows what will happen. And so I think that's a key thing here. We're just going to have to kind of wait and see what happens in the new session.
And then with all of these political action committees formed, do you see them having legs and continuing on with their work?
Right. Yes, I do. I think we'll definitely see the Craft Beverage Coalition continue to raise money. They have said that, you know, this is really only the beginning. We've seen these other legacy wholesale PACs raising money for a long time, and they generally have more money than the Craft Beverage Coalition folks, and the Tavern League as well. And so, yeah, I think we'll definitely just continue to see this. I think it'll come up in one way or another, whether it's in the budget process or standalone bills, but the issue is definitely not going away.
Well, Caitlin, thanks so much for coming by.
Yep, thank you.
Caitlin Farrell is a public affairs and investigative reporter at the Cap Times. Her recent piece is titled "Questions, Disputes Remain in Wisconsin Alcohol Industry as Committee Winds Down." I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.